Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone. I'm Stephen Carter, your host for today, and I'm excited to let you know that we've finally been able to nail down our plans for this year's Salt Lake Summer Symposium. I'll tell you, it wasn't easy navigating all the changing COVID regulations, but we think we found a way to hold an event while keeping everybody safe and healthy. It's going to be a hybrid symposium with an online and an in-person component. And the in-person component will be held at the Mountain America Expo Center in Sandy, Utah, where we held the 2018 and 2019 symposiums. Like last year, this hybrid thing is going to be an experiment. And hopefully it turns out as well as last year's experiment did. To register, go to sunstone.org. We're excited to see you there. I read an article recently in The Atlantic that startled me. Not so much because of its content, which I'd been at least somewhat aware of, but because of the weird connections it had with Mormonism. It was titled, "Why Confederate Lies Live On," by Clint Smith. The tagline for the article was, "For some Americans, history isn't the story of what actually happened. It's the story they want to believe." It starts out with Smith going to the Blandford Cemetery in Petersburg, Virginia, which is apparently one of the largest cemeteries for Confederate soldiers. It had been started in 1860 by local women who wanted to honor their dead fathers, husbands, brothers, and sons. On the grounds is a deconsecrated church that's been renovated into a museum. Its main attractions are the Tiffany stained glass windows, each of which depicts a saint from the New Testament. Now, beneath each saint's feet is an inscription that starts out pretty normal for a church, but then it takes a surprising turn. For example, the one beneath St. Andrew's feet says, "To the glory of God and in sacred memory of Alabama's brave Confederate band. Brave men may die. Right has no death. Truth never shall pass away." And then beneath St. Mark's feet, it reads, "To the glory of God and in memory of South Carolina's sons who died for the Confederacy. He doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth." But probably the most interesting one is the one that goes, "To the glory of God and in memory of Virginia patriots and heroes of the Confederate Army. Eternal right, though all else fail, can never be made wrong." That one is under John the Evangelist's feet. They are quite lovely windows, but Smith, the article's author, writes, "I couldn't revel in the window's beauty without reckoning with what those windows represented." You see, Smith is black, so when he hears the words "Confederate cause," he thinks slavery. As does, for that matter, most of the rest of America. Throughout the article, he meets people who really value their Confederate history, and have set up quite a partition between that history and slavery. One of the supervisors at the museum tells Smith, "I think from the perspective of my ancestors, the Confederate cause was not slavery. My great-great-grandfather fought. He had federal troops coming into Norfolk. He said, 'Nuh-uh, I've got to join the army and defend my home state.'" Then Smith goes to a Memorial Day service being conducted by the Sons of Confederate Veterans, where he hears a speaker say that they need to take back the Confederate narrative. And the narrative that they want to promote was outlined to Smith by one of the attendees, named Jeff. "Everyone always hears the same things. It's all about slavery. And it wasn't. It was about the fact that each state had the right to govern itself." Smith writes, "I asked Jeff whether he thought slavery had played a role in the start of the Civil War." "Oh, just a very small part. I mean, we can't deny it was there. We know slave blocks existed, but only a small number of plantations even had slaves. Much of the article is dedicated to Smith hearing various arguments from the Memorial Day services attendees that diminish the role of slavery and racism in the Civil War and promote the role of states' rights. And then he counters the arguments with scholarship. As I read this article, I was surprised at how the way these Confederate descendants downplay slavery as a major component of the Civil War reminded me of how Mormons downplay polygamy in the early church, especially Jeff, who said, "Oh, slavery was just a very small part. I mean, we can't deny it was there. We know slave blocks existed. Only a small number of plantations ever had slaves." That's the main line of defense a Mormon usually uses when they're feeling threatened by our polygamous past. "Oh, polygamy was just a very small part of Mormonism," they'll say. "Only a small percentage of Mormons actually practiced plural marriage." And then, of course, the LDS Church pours a ton of money into its historical sites. When you go to them, they're clean and well-organized, they're replete with multimedia presentations, entertainment, and missionaries, either in modern or period dress, who are more than happy to construct history for you. The Sons of Confederate Veterans are, you know, a much smaller group than the Mormons, so they have fewer resources, but they understand, right along with the Mormons, that the first thing you have to do is take back the narrative. But what does that even mean, take back the narrative? One of the older men Smith talks to, he puts it this way. "If you write about my ancestors," the air trembled between us, "I want it to be correct. I'm concerned about the truth, not mythology." Now there's an interesting dichotomy, truth and mythology. Is truth really more important than mythology? I think what that man meant is that there is truth, another word for facts, which he believes support his worldview. And then there's mythology, which is a story not supported by facts and runs counter to his worldview. And he declares that facts are more important than mythology. At first blush, I think most of us would probably agree with him about this. But I think that if we really dig into it, we'll find out that he's wrong. The fact is, mythology is much more potent than fact. So, what's the difference between mythology and facts? Well, facts are little pieces of information. They are limited by boundaries. They can only draw their meaning from a particular context. You know, they're like dots spread out on a piece of paper. Mythologies, on the other hand, are the lines that connect those dots in a particular order, creating a particular pattern. Facts can be extremely useful for getting things done. If they describe reality well, we can do things like fly to Mars and gather information with probes and drones. However, there are some things that facts can't do. And one of them is that they can't motivate people. They can't give meaning to someone's life. They can't bring people together in a common cause or drive someone away from that cause. Mythologies are the things that make us either see or not see a fact, or give one fact more weight than another. Think about the fact of someone sneezing without a face mask in a grocery store. A mythology that says there is a pandemic going on would see that sneeze as a possible public health risk. A mythology that says there is no pandemic going on would see it only as an annoyance. Same fact, different mythologies. Let's say Florida suffers a particularly bad hurricane season. In one mythology, It's the result of global climate change caused by excessive human creative carbon emissions. In another, it's God's punishment of the wicked. But the really interesting difference between facts and mythologies is what their goals are. A mythology considers itself successful not when it accomplishes something, but when it makes meaning. This is why, for example, when Zion's Camp completely failed in its mission to take back the land in Missouri, and a dozen people perished in the process, that's why we can now hail it as an important crucible for the people who would later become Mormon leaders. That is a mythology at work, making meaning, which is its only job. Remember that inscription in the Blandford Cemetery Museum window? Eternal right, though all else fail, can never be made wrong. That is how a mythology works. Everything around it may fail, but that doesn't matter, because it's the mythology that interprets the failures. It is the eternal right. This is the reason why people outside of a mythology have such a hard time understanding why it could hold sway over anyone. See, the mistake they're making is that they're trying to measure a mythology by its accomplishments, not by its meaning-making. People who are part of the vaccination mythology, for example, wonder why an anti-vaccination mythology could even exist with all of the evidence that vaccination does indeed reduce disease. It's because the anti-vaccination mythology makes meaning out of its adherents' conviction that bodily autonomy is the highest good. And therefore, vaccination's abuses to the individual outweigh its benefits to the community. Anything that happens will be interpreted to support the mythology of bodily autonomy. On the other hand, the vaccination mythology makes meaning out of its adherents' conviction that community health is worth the individual bodily abuses it entails. Anything that happens will be interpreted to support the mythology of community health. However, that doesn't mean that mythologies won't change in response to their contexts. Mythologies want to survive, and I think that's what we see happening with the Sons of Confederate Veterans and Mormons. It angers Clint Smith, the article's author, that the Sons of Confederate Veterans so blatantly diminished the role of slavery in the Civil War. But now we know that there is a mythology behind that group struggling to survive. American culture looks upon slavery with repugnance now. So, the mythology that drove the Confederacy can no longer use its pro-slavery stance and survive. So, like the Mormons, who once made plural marriage essential to salvation, a requirement for leadership roles, and something worth fighting the United States over, they are backing off of the repugnant doctrine. And that's really interesting, because it means that they have, in fact, capitulated to the current value system. They want to keep their Confederate legacy, but they know they have to diminish its slavery aspect in order to do so. Note that none of them said, "I think slavery is okay," or even, "I think racism is okay." They were, in fact, trying to distance their ancestors and therefore themselves from slavery. In other words, the abolition movement worked. And on the same note, so did the anti-polygamy campaigns. So let's bounce back to the article's tagline. Why are these people ignoring the story of what actually happened in favor of the story they want to believe? What good does it do to divorce yourself from documented facts? Well, it gives them access to one of the most effective social technologies that humanity has developed, namely ancestor technology. You may remember, in my last episode, I talked about social technologies. They're these behavior patterns or mass stories that we develop to increase some aspect of individuals or groups, like organizing them better or providing more motivation. It seems feasible to say that ancestor social technology has been around for as long as we've had language, and it seems to be in most of the world's cultures. Basically, individuals use the stories of their ancestors to build a mythology that gives them a sense of identity, and it motivates them in a particular direction, and it gives their lives meaning. I've actually read studies that show that people who know stories of their ancestors actually have greater resiliency than those who don't. So Mormons who have pioneer ancestry, they know exactly what I'm talking about here. When you come to the difficult points in your life, or when you need to draw on extra strength, many modern-day Mormons find it very effective to remember great-great-grandma so-and-so who crossed the plains. They say, "Hey, I have some of their DNA in my bones. That means I have her strength, or persistence, or imagination, or intelligence, or whatever. So I can do this." You have a built-in motivator, a built-in confidence booster, a built-in heroism. That's actually one of the reasons why I went into writing as a career. It was not for the money. It was because I have some writers in my ancestry. So ancestor social technology really is effective. And the more dramatic your ancestor stories are, the more potent the technology is. So here we have a bunch of people who have soldiers in their ancestry, people who fought and died for a cause. They could draw all kinds of strength and identity from that. But the problem is, American culture at large says that their ancestors fought and died so that they could continue to enslave people, and slavery is now repugnant to the American sensibility. So all of these people are left without what could be a vast reservoir of resilience, motivation, and meaning. And of course, they want to have access to that. So they look for a way to get it back, and their method has been to turn the focus of the Confederate cause from slavery to states' rights, which is a very American ideal. You can see the Mormons doing the same thing. We have all kinds of skeletons in our ancestral closet, including racism and slavery. So we use the same tools these Confederate descendants use to claim our ancestor technology. Like Clint Smith, it bugs a lot of people when Confederate descendants and Mormons ignore documented facts and sort of make up their own version of history so they can have access to various social technologies. I mean, facts should be the driving force behind our perception of history, right? Why not use the power of facts to drive your life instead of mythology? Well, like I said earlier, facts themselves have no motivating power. They're actually inert until a mythology comes along to make use of them. You can give someone all the facts in the world, and they would never fill the function of a single mythology. That's why you shouldn't be surprised when you tell a descendant of a Confederate soldier, "Your ancestors fought and died to retain slavery, which is repugnant to our culture. Therefore, you cannot use them as ancestor technology. But in return, here are some facts." It's really unlikely that they'll think that's a good trade. As one Confederate descendant put it in the New York Times, "You're trying to tell me my ancestors were monsters." Mormons feel the same way when someone tries to replace their mythology with facts. In fact, anyone feels that way, including you and me. And here is where the problems with mythologies become so apparent. I've spent all this time showing why the descendants of Confederate soldiers and Mormons put so much work into claiming the power of ancestor social technology. But what are the other consequences of that? Well, Clint Smith points them out quite powerfully. After his tour of the Blandford Cemetery and the Sons of Confederate Veterans Memorial Day service, he brings us to the Whitney Plantation in Louisiana. As he writes, "The Whitney is surrounded by a constellation of former plantations that host lavish events. Visitors bask in nostalgia, enjoying the antiques and the scenery. But the Whitney is different. This house is a reminder of what slavery built, and the grounds are a reminder of what slavery really meant for the men, women, and children held in its grip." Throughout the plantation, there stand life-size statues of black children. It has a series of walls where the names of 2,200 enslaved children who died in St. John the Baptist Parish from 1823 to 1863 are carved. And in one corner are the ceramic heads of 55 black men impaled on silver stakes. The Whitney is meant to bear witness to the astonishing weight of slavery. And it is from the narrative the Whitney presents that Smith taps into his own ancestor technology. He comes from a people who were deeply wronged for many generations. But they were strong, and he inherited their strength. So when the descendants of Confederate soldiers dismiss slavery from their history, it feels as if they are dismissing Smith, his ancestors, and the horrific suffering they endured. They seem to be questioning the validity of Smith's ancestry, and therefore his own identity and the way he makes meaning of his life. They're essentially relegating the foundation of his mythology to the footnotes of their history. And that brings us to our main conundrum. As you can see, the ancestral social technology of one group can, and often does, work against the ancestral social technology of another group. And the conflicts created by those clashing mythologies are the deepest and most violent ones we have. These kinds of conflicts don't arise over facts. They only arise over mythologies. People sacrifice their lives for mythologies, not facts. You can see that in one of the stained glass windows at the Blandford Cemetery Museum, where it says, "Brave men may die. Right has no death. Truth never shall pass away." Of course, in this case, right and truth are intended to refer to the Confederate cause. And, as we have seen, the Confederate cause is a mythology. This is leading us toward a very interesting question. And that question is, where does the person end and the mythology begin? We've been talking about how people will fight and even die for their mythologies. And if we look at our own lives, we can find mythologies about ourselves that we would fight to maintain because, to us, they are truth. Which story about yourself is so central to your identity that you would sacrifice money, friends, or family for it? This is actually a difficult question to think about because we head into territory where we feel very vulnerable. We go to a place where we feel like the walls must be maintained at all costs. It's likely a place that we've won through sacrifice. For example, a Mormon's testimony. I hear all the time in a testimony meeting, "I don't know where I'd be without the gospel." To those people, the world is chaos, and the only safety is in the church. Perhaps they made great sacrifices to be a part of it. For them, leaving the church is the most frightening thing they can think of. Or, for another example, an ex-Mormon's testimony. For some of them, the church truly is a poisonous place, and their journey out of it is the most heroic one they've ever undertaken. It's a defining journey. So my question is, where do you end and your mythology begin? Let's think about it another way. What if you take away a person's family mythology? What do they have left? Okay. What if you take away their schooling mythology? What's left? How about if we take away their career mythology? Their marriage mythology? Their ancestor mythology? On and on. Is there eventually a point where you have stripped away so many mythologies that there isn't a person left? Or is there something beneath all those mythologies? Maybe that sounds like an arcane question, and maybe not even a valid one. I mean, in the end, isn't a human being an organism? Or, I guess if we want to be religious, a spirit? But there's something that makes me think that mythologies are more central to ourself than we think. And that thing is that people do die for their mythologies. They override the organism's survival directive. Does that mean that meaning is more important than life? Well, we certainly make endless movies about the people who give the ultimate sacrifice, as those stained glass windows say, for truth, or, as we would put it now, for a mythology. This question, if we strip away all our mythologies, is there anything left beneath it all, is interesting for two reasons. One, it's an interesting way to get at what Mormon theology means when it talks about our spirit. Because our theology does say that our spirits are a substance, and that we could indeed find it under all these layers. But what in the world would it look like? What would it be without its mythologies? But I find it even more interesting from a secular point of view. We've already noticed that mythologies are one of humanity's greatest technologies, but also its most explosive source of conflict. So we're asking a very practical question when we wonder if a person is, at core, a bundle of mythologies. Because we definitely treat people and ourselves as if their mythologies are their most essential aspect. Our biggest conflicts arise when a person or group feels that we've overlooked, dismissed, or denigrated one of their core mythologies, because that mythology is their identity. Mythologies are, I guess, kind of the secular world's version of metaphysics. They're invisible things that bring us into real conflict. So when we ask the question, is a person a bundle of mythologies? The answer has real-world applications. If mythologies do make up the core of a person, then we're trapped in an eternal cycle of conflict. Because, as the stories of Eve and Adam, Abel and Cain, and the Lamanites and the Nephites teach us, new mythologies crop up even in the smallest groups. It's never going to stop. But if we aren't, at core, a bundle of mythologies, then what are we? Even if we don't figure it out, being able to ask the question seriously gives us some breathing room that I think we all really need. For example, when we find ourselves reacting to someone overlooking, dismissing, or denigrating a mythology that is important to us, What if we had the mental room to say, oh, that's a mythology that's reacting, not me, and there is a difference. I wonder what the difference is. Then, instead of allowing the mythology to have total control of our reaction, we can watch how it behaves, as if it were not us. What might we learn in a process like that? I'll admit, though, this is a big ask, because we have to do it at precisely the moment when all of our defensive reactions have flared up, when we honestly feel attacked. But I also think that's why being practiced at asking the question is so important. Because don't you want it to be the actual you responding to those difficult situations instead of something that isn't you? Well, that's an interesting question, too. What is the actual you? And is it better than a mythology? I don't know if any of us have the answer to that question. We're too wrapped up in our mythologies. It's as if the mythologies are more real than we are. That's kind of a disconcerting thought. But you have to admit, we certainly seem to act like it. Well, I can tell that I've asked a lot more questions today than I've answered, but that's probably par for the course for me. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of the Sunstone Podcast. Remember to register for the symposium. You know you want to go. And the more people who pre-register, the better the Sunstone staff sleeps at night. Head over to sunstone.org. Well, we'll see you next episode.